The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome, welcome. It's always an honor to be here. And I'll just let you know, backstage, he promised that he's funny, and we are in for a great time, and I think we're right.
Yes. So. Hey, do I know anyone here?
All right.
Sonia doesn't count. Okay, just making sure. Okay.
All right. So thank you for coming out, and we're all excited about this. So, Nicholas, so many people here know your work, and somebody's even giving us music, I think. Tell us a little bit about The Longest Ride for somebody who hasn't followed it yet, but they're excited to hear about it. How would you encapsulate it?
All right. First, how many people have read it? Oh, true fans. Let's start with that. It's been out for a week, people. Come on.
Well, you got to give them a taste of what it's about.
All right, all right. The Longest Ride. Whenever I sit down to write a novel, I always try to do something new and unique, you know, something that you kind of know what you're going to get when you pick up a novel of mine, but then everything else, you want it to be as different as possible. So what makes this one different? This is the first dual love story that I've ever written. What's a dual love story? I will tell you. There are two separate love stories in this story. The first one, do we want to wait? Just kidding. The first love story concerns Ira and Ruth. Ira and Ruth, Ira is, the novel opens, he's 91 years old. And theirs is a love story that spans decades. They're from the South. They live in Greensboro, North Carolina. They are Jewish. And they met in the 1930s after Ruth comes from Austria, fleeing from after the Nazis took over. They annexed Austria and her family arrives in North Carolina. So it's kind of, their story is really one that has a very epic flavor. It traces their entire lives. And it's a life full of ups and downs and adventures and surprises. And it's very enthralling, I would hope. Meanwhile, for all you young people, there's another love story going on. And this is the story of Luke and Sophia. Sophia is a senior in college. She's a sorority girl about to graduate. You know, it's her senior year. She has no idea what she's going to do when she graduates. Well, she meets a guy named Luke who works at the family ranch, and he happens to be a professional bull rider. And part of the fun of this novel is trying to figure out how on earth the story of Ira and Ruth on one hand is ever going to intersect with the story of Luke and Sophia's on the other. But intersect they do.
And I thought I was a hardened reporter type. I cried when they intersected.
Yeah, thank you, I think.
It was a good kind of cry.
Okay, good.
And in this book, you return to something that many people have expected as a theme, love over time, love through hardship. And it seems as though it's a message that you really keep wanting to get through to people.
Yeah, love over time. I did that in 1996, and it worked out okay, so I thought I'd do that again, right? I think it's love over time, but I think if there's really a defining element of the characters in the novel that I've written, because they've all been different, but whether you're talking about Noah or Allie or Jamie or Landon in A Walk to Remember, or Ira and Ruth, or even Luke and Sophia, it's that once I craft a characters, I guess they're the kind of characters who, once they truly and deeply fall in love with the right person, they love that person forever. And that's really, I guess, it comes from my parents, my grandparents, me and my wife, insanity. I don't know.
You got some awe from that one. Also, there's an element in there, the character Ira, he really spends He wants people to get it. And so much as people are, of the book is people not understanding what some things mean to him about that love story, that it's important for people to recognize what it really means.
Yeah. That's, yeah. She's good. You know, there's a line in the novel, and it basically says, Ira says, I want people to understand. And you don't necessarily know what that means. But this is a guy who's a very simple person in many ways. You know, he met a girl and fell in love, and he loved her forever. And that's Ira's story. And it can be summed up. But, you know, when I'm crafting Ira, you know, you don't want to go over the top with it. So Ira's voice, I must say, was actually one of the more fun voices I've ever created. Because if you want to create a character where a notion like that, to love forever, the main thing you have to do is to keep this character authentic. This character has to feel real. And to do that, there's got to be an honesty to his voice, an honesty to the way he tells his own story, and an authenticity in the way he views himself, his flaws and the things that he's done well. And so as you're crafting through all of this authenticity, I think that's what really makes this feeling for his wife resonate even more, because you understand that, look, this character feels very real to me. At least that's the hope.
In this book, love letters figure prominently. Something people
again
have seen.
Yeah.
Again. But I think people will like it. And I thought find it interesting that often in the book, what is written is more important than what is said. Is that an important theme for you?
Yeah. You know, I like the epistolary form of writing. For all of you who didn't do too well on the SATs, verbal section, that would be the inclusion of letters within a novel. I was told it was a very literary crowd, but I'm not.
talked you up.
Yeah, exactly. So I just think it adds an element. It's another way to capture someone's voice. And I've done it in a lot of my novels, whether it was The Notebook or Message in a Bottle or Dear John, and I return to that in The Longest Ride. And it's just another way to allow for the reader to get to know the character. And used sparingly and effectively, I think it's a very effective way to genuinely evoke emotion. And that's what more than anything, that's what I strive to do. Is to evoke genuine emotion. I'm going to take a detour here. And why would I want to do that? And let me tell you, every genre that you read, whether it's literary fiction or a horror novel, they all have a specific goal. So if you're reading a thriller novel, the author should have the goal of trying to thrill the reader. Makes sense, right? If you're reading a horror novel, the author should have the goal of trying to scare. If you're reading a romance novel, you should really feel a sense of romantic fantasy, right? So what's the purpose of what I write? What do I write? I have a hard time describing it. It's not a romance novel. It's not Southern fiction, but what is it? The goal of what I try to do is... what I try to do is to move the reader through all of the emotions of life, all of them, so that by the time you close the cover, you feel as if you've lived a mini life. That's it. I'm not just trying to thrill you or scare you or romantic fantasy. I want you to feel it all. And to do that, there's a couple of things you have to do. You have to genuinely evoke emotion, as opposed to manipulating it. And what does that mean? It means, for instance, in The Longest Ride, when Luke finally tells Sophia that he loves her, and I hope I'm not ruining this by saying this. I'm assuming there's some familiarity with my work. Lots of characters fall in love, okay? By the time you reach that point, as the reader, you should think to yourself, well, no kidding, Luke, I knew that 10 pages ago. It took you long enough. That's genuinely evoked. Whereas if he says it and you're like, whoa, how can you do that? You barely know her. Right? So that's genuinely evoked. And then the other part is you want to, you strive to be dramatic without being melodramatic. And it's a really fine line to walk because you want the story to feel very real, that it could happen to everybody. So if you feel like it can happen to everybody and you move through all of the emotions of life, you feel as if you've had a full experience of life in the reading of it. And that's the purpose of what I do.
But love letters aren't just a trick, an idea that you pulled out. It's something you've done.
Yeah.
You famously did it with your own wife when you were courting.
Right.
Is it something you continue to do? Do you still write her letters?
Yes. Every anniversary, my wife gets a nice letter recapping the previous year. So she has 24 of them. And they are so good. Because I work really hard. You know, it's interesting when you put these love letters into a novel, or the ones I write to my wife, you know, you guys read them in 3 or 4 minutes. They don't take 3 or 4 minutes to write. Let me tell you, these things can take a day and a half to get it just right. You know, 10, 12, 13 hours sometimes to get it just right.
I think a lot of people love your work because they're fascinated by the human heart, a good story. I would imagine you're always looking for new material, listening to people's stories. As you collect them, what do you find is the biggest obstacle for people when it comes to love? I mean, I'm sure you think, okay, what will the obstacle be for characters here? What do you hear over and over?
Boy, it varies, and I've really tried to explore the obstacles in different ways throughout the course of my work. So I don't think there is any one answer, you know, in the, let's just take The Notebook. Initially, she's only there for a short period of time, just the summer. So that's an obstacle, distance. Then she comes back and she's engaged. There's an obstacle. Then they want to be together toward the end of their lives, but they can't because she can't remember him. There's 3 obstacles in 1. If you're going to write a love story, you got to have obstacles. So I've tried to cover everything from can't commit to can't get over someone's wife to the way I met you is a lie. The lucky one, to Dear John, I've got to go serve my country and I've got to leave. So there's a lot of different ways. And there are ways, of course, in The Longest Ride, too. Obstacles.
You've talked about the fact that it's not an accident that you chose this genre, that you said there's a place for a good voice here. And a friend of mine was saying today, I think it's also the fact that he's a guy. He brings something to it in a world that we're often used to hearing women's voices.
Wait a minute.
He brings something.
We got to keep something secret here.
How much of that do you think is, I mean, your work is wildly popular, that you're bringing that force to it?
Yeah. It's interesting because, the being a guy thing it comes up a lot, right? Is that why these books are so popular? And it's funny, while women tend to dominate the romance novel genre, these types of books over history or stories have tended to be dominated by men. So let's go over some. Romeo and Juliet, they're Shakespeare. It's the same thing I do. Not saying I'm Shakespeare. He's a much better writer. I'm perfectly willing to accept that. But the themes are the same, right? It's young love, obstacles, get together, tragedy in the end. Does that sound familiar, right? A Farewell to Arms by Ernest Hemingway. There was a guy, right? Casablanca was written by men. From Here to Eternity was written by men. Let's say Love Story by Eric Segal. That was a man. Bridges of Madison County was a man. The Horse Whisperer, Nicholas Evans, that was a man. And those are probably the closest in theme to what I do. So it's interesting to me. So yeah, it could be that I'm a guy, sure. And my editor says so. So I guess, you know, she's a smart lady. She went to Penn.
You like that?
So yeah, I think that's probably part of it. But in the end, I think that male or female, in the end, people are drawn to stories that they like. It doesn't matter to me if it's written by a man or a woman, as long as it's a good story.
In The Longest Ride, death is a tentpole, you could say as well, and it's been the case in some of your other books as well, that this is important, what it does to somebody to realize something only when somebody's gone, whether it's a lover or a child or a parent, that there's an importance to, you can't get that back.
Right. Sadly, there is tragedy in The Longest Ride. I know that's new. I often say that, and it's a rule, and it's a rule not only for literature, but it's a rule for life. And it goes like this. All great love stories, all, 100%, must, by definition, end in tragedy. Think about it. See, around the world, tens of thousands of people die every day. We all still go on, right? Why? Because we don't love them. We didn't know them. Now imagine if it's your spouse, or your child, or your parents, or your sister, or a close friend. Your life, the world seems to come to an end. Now, the greater the love, the greater the tragedy. There is no way around that. And so all of my novels, deal with some element of tragedy for two reasons. Number one, it's unavoidable. Everybody in here has been sad. Everyone in here either has lost someone already that was close to them, or they will. It's inevitable. So I do it because it's real. And again, what I try to do is be authentic and honest and create real worlds. But number two, you have to have some element of tragedy or sadness in a novel, in the kind of novels that I write, because I'm trying to move you through all of the emotions of life. If you don't have any sadness at all, then does the happiness means less? Does that make sense? I mean, now, believe me, I don't always bump off one of the couples. Sometimes I kill a parent or something, sometimes I kill a dog or whatever. But look, I try to keep it varied here. I've had a lot of happy endings. But if I eliminated that sadness for loss, then the novel wouldn't feel real. It would just be escape, which is fine, but that's not what I do. Right? I move you through all of the emotions of life.
You talk a lot about the craft of writing. You're an architect about your books. If you want an interesting read, go to nicholassparks.com and look at his writing notes. I love what you wrote about The Notebook, that you're always told, kill your darlings as a writer. An opening scene, you take it down from pages down to one line.
Yeah.
So nothing's an accident, it seems, when you read it in your books. In The Longest Ride, you talk about Ira and Ruth. They go through a tough time in the marriage. They think they'll come apart. You give it two paragraphs. I thought that was it. You tell us so much about them, but you cover years in two paragraphs. That was a choice.
Yeah.
Why?
Why? Because sometimes less is more. It really comes down to that. A great description is to say something like, you could start a book like this. You can say, the city was fantastic. You had lots of people going out at night, and there were fantastic restaurants, and the streets were bustling, and they were clean, and people were throwing joyful parties and all of this great stuff. At the same time, in another part of the city, there were a lot of there was some poor people and poverty and crime. And I could go on and on and on for two pages about that. Or I can write, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Do you see what I mean? Whenever I'm writing a novel, pacing is very important. The pace of the novel—it's a critical component. You don't want a novel that's too long or too short. So the architect is actually very good. These are things I evaluate. And if I tell you less, if I give you just enough, then what happens is you allow the reader's imagination to fill in the blanks. That's exactly what happens. If you ever read a description of one of my characters, you'll be amazed at how little I ever write. It might tell you the color of the hair, their eyes, their height, how they look in jeans, which they'll look good. I don't say much. But by doing that, it allows you to fill in. Because if I said, blonde hair, blue eyes, you're like, okay, I got it. But there was a cleft in her chin and a mole by her ear. And you're like, wait, now you're throwing me off. Do you see what I'm... It's a very fine balance. I feel like I'm giving a lecture on how to write a novel, by the way. But that's why. So two paragraphs, because by that point in the novel, you knew him, you knew her, you knew their history to that point, and that was just enough. Any more, you would have belabored the point.
So we'll move away from the lecture on writing, because I think a lot of you want to know a little bit more
about me,
about Nicholas Sparks. So I asked you a question while we were waiting, because I read it on Wikipedia, which of course is not always true, that your parents had separated for a while, and I asked you if it was true, and you said, I don't know, I think so. Did that inform, when you look back, do you think it informs your writing now?
No. My parents, okay, so my dad was at, we were living in Los Angeles, we're dirt poor, and my dad was getting his PhD and he had to write his dissertation. So I went off with mom and my brother and sister to Nebraska for a year. He wrote his dissertation, then we all met up, you know, 1 year later in Sacramento, California, which is where I spent the majority of my youth, where he got a job at Cal State University, Sacramento. Have you heard of it? Harvard of the West? Well, that's what my brother says. He graduated from there. I don't know if it's true. I didn't attend there. But does it inform my writing? No. You know, look, I was 7, 8 years old, right? I don't know what I was thinking at 7 or 8, you know? If it's snowing, I'm thinking, go play in the snow. No, I don't think so.
So you go to Notre Dame, and you're busy. You're on a track and field scholarship. You're getting a business degree. But you start writing.
Mm-hmm.
You have some early books that are in the drawer, a couple, I think, three before we get to The Notebook. What made you know back then, this is what I want to do, it's got to be a part of my life?
Oh, it didn't start like that at all. You know, I think everyone has this great vision, right, that they're like, oh, writers, they must be writing in their journals at 7 or 8 or something. Look, I like to read. I like to read when I was growing up. I loved Stephen King. That's where I left. I'm like, wow, this is cool books, right? So I was 19 years old. I finished my first year in college, and I had run all year, but I was injured. I had Achilles tendonitis, plantar fasciitis. So I went home for the summer between my freshman and sophomore year. And I went to the doctor, and I said, you know, hey, how do I get better? He says, oh, it's so easy. Don't run. I'm like, oh, you know, this is all I wanted to do at that point in my life. I had dreams of the Olympics and all that stuff. I mean, and so I kind of went, no, I didn't kind of go. I literally went crazy. I mean, I had all these endorphins going that I wasn't burning off anymore. And I was moping and spending hours imagining all my competitors training and falling behind. It was miserable. And my mom got tired of it. And she said, look, don't just pout, do something. And I'm like, what? She's like, I don't know. Go write a book. I said, okay. I didn't have anything else to do. I couldn't run. So about 6, 7 weeks later, I sat down and grabbed a typewriter, right, and hacked out a 300-page novel over the next 6 to 7 weeks. It was a horror novel. It was terrible. But man, yeah, I realized that I kind of enjoyed that because I liked a good story, right? And I said, okay, that's pretty cool. But I never thought I could make a living at it, so I went back to college. Didn't majored in business finance, didn't write another thing for 3 years, and then I was in my senior year, and I got bored. And I had this great class, first semester of my senior year, so it was American fiction since the 1950s, and I said, wow, these are some great books. We read Catch 22 and Slaughterhouse-Five and Lolita and Catcher in the Rye, a lot of great, great books. The Invisible Man, we read Going After Cassiato, a whole bunch of great books. Bullet Park by John Cheever. And what really struck me about those books was the strength of voice. And I said, you know, let me give it another shot. So my second semester, senior year, I wrote another novel because I was bored. But again, I didn't think I could do anything with it.
You go on to do a lot of different things. You sell real estate, wait tables, sell dental appliances on the phone?
Dental products by phone. That's right, I did. Worked for a denticator. Sold the first disposable prophy angle.
Wow.
You're all like, what the heck is that?
Exactly.
You have the handpiece. Imagine your teeth getting cleaned. And they put the little thing on with the bristles, the toothbrush part. Well, before I came along and denticator, really was denticator and then me because I was just an employee, that piece they popped on was metal. And they had to clean it in an autoclave. So this came in with the first plastic one where you popped it on. And I would bet that virtually all of you have the plastic ones now.
Yeah. You can thank me for that.
Cutting edge, even back then, this guy, huh? That's right.
So tell us about writing. Was it just something you enjoyed doing in the spare time? You just thought, I'll keep taking a crack at it?
No, were you thinking? No, then I kind of did nothing. I kind of bounced from job to job till I was like 25. And by then I had a child, and my wife came to me with some really good advice. She came to me and she said, Nick, get a job. So I did. I sold pharmaceuticals, and then that was going good till about 28, and then I had a midlife crisis. I'm going to tell you about that.
Why don't you do that?
Because I think it's funny. So, okay, you know, there are these major historical events, and when they happen, you kind of remember where you were. So, you know, like I remember where I, for some older people in the audience may remember where they were when Kennedy got shot. I remember where I was when I heard that Ronald Reagan was shot. I remember where I was when the Challenger exploded. I remember where I was on 9/11. And I remember exactly where I was in May of 1994 when the last episode of Cheers aired, right? It's coming back to you now, isn't it? Yeah, I was tough. Look, I stayed awake all night long. I'm not kidding. I was so traumatized. And you know what was funny? The funny thing was I didn't even particularly like the show. But it traumatized me. I'm not kidding. I stayed awake all night. What? Okay, why? Other than...
I don't think he needs me.
I'll tell you why. It was funny. It was because that show had come to mean something to me. It had come to represent something. Because that show had started when I was a high school sophomore. Okay? And here it was finally ending 13 years later, 12 and a half years later, and I was 28 years old. And as I was laying there in bed, I couldn't help but think about how much my life had changed in this 12-year period. Massive changes. Let's see, I'd gotten a driver's license, graduated from high school, graduated from college, met a girl, got married, had children, moved across the country, bought a house, even had a job, right? So much had changed. And yet, I couldn't help but remember back to who I'd been when the show first started, when I was 15 years old. And at that time, you know, like I said, I wanted to go to the Olympics, right? I wanted to chase a dream. And I liked that about me. I liked the fact that I was chasing a dream, even if it in the end didn't pan out. There was something about chasing it. And I'm laying there at 28 saying, you know what? I'm not chasing a dream. I'm living. I'm paying the bills. But what about my dream, right? So I said, so what can I do and still pay the bills? Because we had a mortgage and kids. What can I do, still provide for my family, and chase a dream? I said, aha, I know. I'm going to try writing again. But unlike those earlier novels, this time I'm going to give it a real shot.
And that was The Notebook.
That was it. I could tell you all about that.
Well, I think most people here would want to know, you send this book in, it's in the slush pile, it gets picked out and becomes the million-dollar book.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
It was fair. What was it like? I mean, that's a dream probably for any number of people in here, especially if you write. What is that like?
Well, it was interesting. I wrote the novel, and then I didn't know, and you finally get an agent, and it comes in, and, you know, you get this phone call, and you're like, wow, that's pretty wild. You know, you don't believe it. That's your first thing. You hang up the phone, you're like thinking two things. What's the catch? And then, uh-oh, they're going to take it away. That's what you think. And then I guess maybe it was my business finance background, but as much as I was, because it did get a million-dollar advance up front, but I didn't change my life at all for the most part. I didn't tell anybody. I told my family and a couple of neighbors, but I didn't tell my boss. I didn't tell anyone at work. I told him I'd sold the book, but not for how much. Because, if you take that money and you lop off 15% for an agent, then cut the rest of it in half, right? You're about $425, which is a staggering sum of money. I will admit that. But I was 28 years old. I had two kids. I had a mortgage. I said, what is that enough for? I could pay off my mortgage. I could put money in the kids' college fund. I can put some into retirement. I said, but after that, there's I'm going to have electric bills the rest of my life. I'm going to have food bills. You know, I might drive somewhere and have to put gas in the car. But as exciting as it was, you didn't know if it was going to, A, sell out of stores, right? I mean, I remember after I walked into a Barnes & Noble, and I walked in there, and there was 50,000 volumes and titles in there. And I'm like, how on earth is anyone going to find my book in the stack of all these books? Right? Because most bookstores aren't ordering a lot. They might order one or two or three copies and stuff them back there in the S section, right between Shakespeare and Steinbeck. So that was one. And then the other part was I didn't know if I could write a second one. Right? So what if I don't? Quit my job? I liked my job. It was easy. Paid well. So I said, we're just going to keep this kind of quiet for a while.
Okay, last question for me before we go to the audience. We know that you've talked a bit about being a person of faith. You've started this high school around it. Does that influence what you write and what you bring to your characters?
Yeah, to a certain extent. Faith, yeah. Faith, yes. Doctrine, not so much. Not so much. Or even specific religion, not so much. For me, and maybe it was, I don't know if it's as much faith as it is just an optimism, right? I kind of see glasses half full. And so when I think of humanity, you know, I tend to think that most people try to do the right thing most of the time. Nobody's perfect. We all make mistakes. But, you know, there's a lot of authors who make their living writing in these really, really dark worlds. And I'm like, all I can think is, really? I mean, your stuff has to come from somewhere. So most of my characters try to do the right thing most of the time. That's honest and truly most of the people I meet in my life. So that probably more than faith. With that said, faith will inform it in a couple of different ways. You know, if I'm writing about teenagers, they don't engage in premarital relations. I don't know if that's a faith thing or a parent thing, to be quite honest. That's one I don't write about. I don't glamorize adultery. And I don't shy away from faith if it's intrinsic to the story. So, for instance, in A Walk to Remember, Jamie was the daughter of a Christian Baptist minister. So that's, look, that shaped her life. That it's going to play a role because of the story. In The Longest Ride, Ira and Ruth are Jewish, and their lives are very much shaped by the Holocaust after the war. That also influences it. So I don't shy away from it. Also, you got to realize, I live in the South. Look, the South, there's a church on every corner. Just the way it is. There's churches. There's a lot of military. There's a lot of guns and fishing. And it's the South. A lot of dogs. I mean, all these shows you see on TV about the South, yeah, it's kind of like that. You know, these cliches come from somewhere, and it hasn't changed that much, right? I mean, I love it. I'm very comfortable there. But that's what it's like. And if you don't write about that kind of stuff, you're not really accurately portraying the area, right? It'd be like writing about Philadelphia without doing the history. It's a unique history. You can't do it, right?
All right. So let's get some of you all involved.
Let's
I'm sure a lot of people. The first hand I saw go up is right there. She cannot wait. Wait, they're going to bring you a microphone.
Hello.
Hi.
A lot of your books have been made into movies.
And yes.
I'm just curious, do you have any influence on who gets casted in those roles?
Do I have any influence on who gets cast in my films? Yes, lots. I'm one of the voices in the room. You know, casting is a studio decision. Producer decision, director decision, and I'm one of those voices in the room as well. So without question, I do. I've liked the casts we've had. I just wish I could have got some good-looking guys, huh? just one, maybe, right?
Were you
Ryan
sad?
Ryan Gosling, yeah. Channing Tatum, Kevin Costner, right?
Were you sad when Ryan Gosling and Rachel McAdams broke up? I think everybody wanted them to get married in real life, too.
Yeah, they all wanted them to be Noah and Allie, but they're their own people.
Yeah. Over here. We've got two, one behind the other.
I didn't have a question until her question. So who would you like for The Longest Ride?
Oh. Like I'm going to answer that. We have some ideas in mind, and we're batting casting around. This film is on Fast Track. The screenplay should be done by October. We should be getting the director attached November or December. Casting will be then going December and January, and it's going into production in February because it will be released in February of 2015. It takes about a year to put a film together. So yeah, I've got some ideas, but it's interesting. You might have someone that you want, but there's lots of reasons people fall out. You know, they're filming something else at that time. They just came off of filming something and they want a break. They're too expensive. There's all sorts of things, you know?
Okay, there was a lady behind you. Yeah.
Good evening.
Hi.
Hello. I have read all of your books, my favorite being The Wedding.
Yes.
And I will say I went through all the emotions that you said
Thank
with that
you.
Book. So I would really love for that one to be a movie. Is there any chance?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. The Wedding, for those who don't know, it's follow-up to The Notebook, right? And it's interesting. What happened was because The Notebook was the very first film deal I did, you kind of have to take the contract they offer. I don't have to do that anymore. But back then I had to. And that contract specified that New Line Cinema has the rights to recurring characters. And New Line Cinema retains the right of last offer. So because of that, no other studios will bid. And right now, New Line is not showing any interest in redoing it. Why? I don't know. At the same time, I have three films coming on tap. The Best of Me, actually, will go into production in January or February. As I said, The Longest Ride, also in February. The Best of Me is scheduled to come out October 2014. That's a super fast turnaround. And then The Longest Ride, February of 2015. And then The Choice should be going into production later this year as well. So, so, in time, perhaps The Wedding, but it's kind of in a queue right now. We got to move through some of these other ones.
There have been some hands in the back there. Can we grab some of the people in the middle in the back?
Are we ever going to see a book based on those letters to your wife?
Are we ever going to see a book based on the letters to the wife? Maybe. Who knows? I don't know. I don't plan on it, but...
There's, I think, a gentleman in my there in the back. Yeah.
It's a guy.
It's a guy.
It's like spotting a California condor.
There's another
in my
one
audience.
Right there.
I'm just kidding. Thank you, gentlemen, who came. Probably
Hi, Mr.
with your wives. Hi. Yeah.
I'm going to stand up, yeah. Hello.
Hi.
The Choice is my absolute favorite book you've ever written. And I just want to know, where did you get the inspiration for that beautiful novel?
For The Choice.
Yes.
Choice. The Choice was one of those novels that was really inspired by a character, a person that I knew. The first character that came to mind was Travis. And Travis was my brother. And I tried to put him into a story. And at the same time, it's very interesting trying to keep my audience happy. I have to put a lot of thought into this because the reality is that people kind of like to read books that they can relate to, right? So, and some of that has to do with the age of the characters, all right? So, but the problem is my readers range in age from, 12 to 100. So, I mean, if I write a teen story, how do I get someone who's older to really like it? Right? Well, it's the same thing with The Choice. The Choice, so what you have to do is you balance everything and you choose your next book and you weigh whatever and you make your decision. But at the same time, you want to keep happy that audience who originally found you. One of the big mistakes that authors make is this. They write a book that everybody likes, if they're very fortunate. And then little by little, they begin to write something different. Or the other option is they pretty much write the same book over and over again. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to kind of straddle this. I didn't want to be so different, but I didn't want to be the same. So The Notebook is structured exactly like, I'm sorry, The Choice is structured very much like The Notebook. And it was just simply a way of saying, hey, thank you to all you readers who really like that one. Let me give you a slightly different version of this. If you like that one, you'll love this one. And then we'll use my brother as inspiration. So that's how I chose it.
There's a green hand. I just see a green arm there.
An alien.
I just wanted to ask you if you have a favorite of your books that you've written and why.
Do I have a favorite of the books I've written? No. The Longest Ride right now, because I'm talking about it so much. I think The Longest Ride is very good. What I can say is it's the thing that I'm most proud of in my career. And whether or not you all notice, it's something that I'm proud of, and that is I've never gotten lazy. I didn't just write the same book. I really try to stretch because I understand that if you're going to spend your money and take the time to read it, I want to give you something that is the best work that I can do. So I look back at every book and I see the originality and the challenges and what made it different and why I did it. And all of those original reasons still ring very true to me. I like them all. I like them all.
Right down here.
Hi, I have a question. I'm from California. And I'm wondering why you haven't toured over in the West.
Wondering why. I have. There's only so many places I can go, right? on a book tour. I mean, I have five children. I've got a wife. I have movies to be made. I have novels to write. I'm moving The Notebook to Broadway. I've got a television company. So there's a lot. Oh, yeah, it's going to be awesome. So what we do is whenever I tour, it's usually 10 to 12 cities, of which five are claimed. Five are claimed. Carolinas and New York. I leave seven. Seven places. So here I am in Philly this time, you know. But I've been to California. I've had numerous signings in Los Angeles, the Bay Area, Sacramento, and San Diego.
I saw the lady in pink right there. The one behind you, her hand went up first.
My son is a Notre Dame grad, and I'm just wondering, any future domers with your children, do you think?
Yeah, any domer, maybe.
Maybe?
Who knows?
Go Irish?
No. Sure, go Irish.
All right.
I coached a lot of kids who went to a lot of different colleges, so I kind of root for them all. Yeah, I like the Irish. I'll watch them on Saturday. I don't live and die with the Irish like a lot of Notre Dame people.
My cousin, Monk Malloy.
He's your cuz?
He's my cuz.
You know, he taught my book, The Notebook.
I know.
And you know what he said about it? He didn't think it was very good. And I said, that's because you're a priest. Trust me, this is good stuff here. This is a deep love.
You know what Monk used to say, CSC stands for strictly cash. Cash, strictly cash.
Over here.
I like the flower.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So I was wondering if you have any advice for somebody who loves writing but isn't majoring it in college, just like you did.
Yeah, I think that's great. I don't think you should major in it. Most authors didn't. Grisham, or name them, David Baldacci, or Lee Child, or Gillian Flynn, none of them majored in writing. I think that you have to read, and you have to read a lot. And then you just have to really start, then you just have to take a crack at it one day. Remember, you know, Stephen King had five books before his first one was published. I had a couple. Most authors follow that kind of pattern. So write one. Don't think that that first one you write necessarily is going to be it, but see if it's good. You know, if it's not, see what happens with it. And if it doesn't, write a second one. Write a third one. That's the great thing about writing is you can do it anywhere. And in the end, you know, you have to be your own judge. You have to see whether it's working, right?
Okay, I haven't gotten to the back on this side, so let's get somebody from back there.
Can I finish that, though, since she wants
Go
to
ahead.
Know? When you read, and you have to read in a variety of genres, but when you read, really try to be perceptive about whether something works and be honest how well it works. Like, for instance, if you read a book and you've realized that you love a character suddenly, and it's only been four pages, stop, fold down the page and keep reading or whatever. But take time, some time, to figure out why you like the character. Was it their voice? Was it the action? Was it how they responded? How much of it was narrative? How much of it was dialogue? How much of it was strict introspection? Did it go in the past? Was it mainly focused on the present? How much did I actually know about all this? Why, and then why did I like him or her, right? All right, so you learn that. Well, now, you know one way to create a character that a reader will like, right? You know one way. You have to do that over and over. How do you build suspense? How do you build original dialogue? What do you do? You know, those are the important things. And then always try to be a good writer. Strunk and White's a pretty good thing. Avoid adverbs.
Anybody back
there? I have a question here. Any plans for 3 weeks with my brother turning into a production?
No. 3 weeks with my brother? No. I mean, who would play me?
I don't know, but I think Ryan Gosling could still do his could do his part for Broadway.
I think you just want to look at Ryan Gosling. I mean, which is reasonable. Probably not. No, that's the memoir, and it's good. It's a story about brotherhood. It's something, if you haven't read it, I will tell you, I go around on tours. Aside from The Notebook, 3 Weeks with My Brother is the second favorite book for those who, and they're like, no, I don't want to read that. I'm like, look, I'm going to move you through all the emotions of life. It's a good one, except this is real.
Right. We've got a gentleman in the middle here with the red shirt.
Welcome to Philly.
Thank you. Go Eagles.
So, so going back to the writing, the process, do you sit down and schedule time? Do you sit down on Monday morning and start to write it? Do you do it when you want to do it and how long it goes? And do you do it in the same spot?
I generally write in the same spot, but I don't have to. I can write anywhere, on planes, in hotel rooms, laying on the floor, wherever. It doesn't matter. When I'm in the process of writing, it's usually I hit the office about 9:30 or 10, and I write till about 3:30. When I sit down to write, I try to write 2,000 words. And sometimes it takes 4 hours. On awesome days, it takes 3. Most days, about 6. Some days, 10. And on those 10-hour days, sometimes I might stop at 1,500 words or something. But that's generally how I do it. So there's some sort of a schedule. It's not 7 days a week. I've never understood people who like to write 7 days a week. I'm very jealous of the Stephen Kings and Nora Roberts of the world. I need to write, and then I need to process what I've written, and edit what I've written, and figure out what I'm writing next. So for me, 3 to 4 days a week early on in a book when it's hardest, and then probably toward the end, 5 or 6 days a week, simply because I know I'm getting toward the end and I want to finish it. Now, that doesn't mean the other 3 or 4 days a week I'm just lounging around poolside. I got films, I got TV, I got Broadway, I got 5 kids. My wife and I founded a school. I run a foundation. So there's always a lot going on. And then, like I said, I have to edit and then think of what I'm writing next.
There's a lady here in the yellow shirt.
I have to have your opinion on this. two questions. Has your wife read 50 Shades of Grey, and what is your opinion about that movie, that book being made into a movie?
Neither my wife or I have read it, not for any other reason. I think I tried. I just wasn't my cup of tea, I guess. So I have no opinion on it one way or the other, because I haven't read it. As far as the film, look, Hollywood, we might all think that Hollywood is in the business of making high quality fare, but really that's not their purpose. You know, they try to make movies that will make money at the box office. So will it? Maybe. You never know.
All right. I'm going to end with this lady in the gray jacket right here.
Oh, but I had my question.
I know, I'm so sorry.
I am so excited to ask you about this. I teach sixth graders writing.
Right.
And what you just said about having them read, I'm trying to have them do that and notice. So the hardest thing to teach them is how to teach voice. Any suggestions?
Yay, boy. I will tell you, voice is tough. Voice is tough. And it's hard. Most authors don't do it well. Voice is tough. I think if you're talking about sixth graders, what you want to do okay. No, I'm thinking about this. I'm trying to look, I get it. Right, I get it. I get what you're doing. Look, I founded a school. I'm trying to give you a good lesson here. What I want you to do is to tell them to do this. To have them describe their room in their mother or father's voice. Not theirs. And you don't just want a list of descriptions. And then as a teacher, what you're going to want to do is to say, open that with what's the first thing your mom's going to say when she opens the door. And then have it be in her thoughts. Say, you're off at school. Your mom walks into your room. Start it with one thing she says, like, why on earth can he put the socks in the drawer? Or, how can he stand such a gloomy room? So you start with one thing that she would say, not him, but what his mom or dad would say, or sister or brother. Okay?
Good advice.
Thanks. Alas.
Alas, indeed, it has come to an end.
The party's over.
Well, thank you, Nicholas Sparks, for coming and spending this time.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.